Was University Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly says people coming from the 7 Muslim-majority nations currently under a temporary travel restriction may remain under that ban indefinitely. He also said other countries could be added to the list. But Kelly said the vast majority of Muslims entering the U.S. can do so without hindrance.
The vast majority of the 1.7 billion Muslims that live on this planet, the vast majority of them have, all other things being equal, have access to the United States.
President Donald Trump's executive order suspends entry to all refugees for 120 days, bans Syrian refugees indefinitely, and blocks those from Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia from entering the U.S. for 3 months. White House spokesman Sean Spicer defended the order as a way to protect Americans.
It's trying to make sure that people understand that the process is working correctly, it's working very well, that the government is doing what it's supposed to protect its people. And that's the number one thing that we can do.
Meanwhile, hundreds of State Department officials have reportedly signed an internal dissent memo protesting the ban. Spicer said they should get with the program or they can go. UN Chief Antonio Guterres criticized the travel restriction as a blind measure that likely will fan extremist propaganda. 4 men charged with directing a major heroin trafficking ring have been extradited from Kenya to the United States. One of the suspects, Baktash Akasha, who prosecutors say led a Kenyan crime family involved in distributing heroin and methamphetamines. Another suspect is his brother, Ibrahim. The charges stem from a U.S. investigation into the Akasha organization, believed to be a major smuggling operation connecting the poppy fields of Afghanistan to European and American cities. This is VOA News. The next round of U.N.-sponsored peace talks on Syria has been delayed from February 8 to 20. U.N. Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura said it will allow a ceasefire arranged in late December to take hold. Efforts to shore up the truce was the object of January talks in Kazakhstan. The U.N. diplomat said the disparate opposition will have more time to come up with a delegation.
If by 8th of February the opposition will not be ready to come up with a unified group, I will have to apply what I've not yet applied to actually select the delegation.
Meanwhile, the World Food Program announced Tuesday it's resuming food airdrops to the government-held city of Deir al-Zour, besieged by Islamic State fighters. New U.S.-UN Ambassador Nikki Haley Tuesday said the world should be alarmed at the latest Iranian ballistic missile test, which she said violates a 2015 international nuclear agreement with Tehran. Haley warned the missile launched Sunday was capable of carrying a nuclear warhead.
They know that they are not supposed to be doing any production of ballistic missile testings that can carry nuclear weapons. So if you look at what they've done, here they have a payload of 500 kilograms that could go in a range of 300 kilograms. That is more than enough to be able to deliver a nuclear weapon.
Iran said it would never use missiles to attack another country, insisted missile tests are neither part of the nuclear accord or a Security Council resolution endorsing the pact. The UN Security Council Tuesday expressed grave concern over what it called a dangerous deterioration of security in eastern Ukraine in fighting between pro-Russian separatists and Ukrainian troops. The council called for immediate return to the Minsk ceasefire. Ukraine's ambassador Volodymyr Yelchenko said the fighting centers around Avdiivka despite a two-year truce.
The fighting going on for fifth day right now. There is a lot of casualties. The whole area is basically cut off electricity and any other supplies.
At least 8 people are known to have been killed, dozens wounded in the latest violence. President Donald Trump late Tuesday nominated appellate court Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court to fill the seat vacated by the death of Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. Trump praised him as a brilliant jurist.
Not only are we looking at the writings of the nominee, and I studied them closely, but he is said to be among the finest and most brilliant, oftentimes, the writings of any judge for a long, long time.
The 49-year-old Gorsuch expected to face stiff confirmation hearings in the Senate. A London-based environmental group, Global Witness, Tuesday accused senior Honduran politicians and business leaders of leading a violent crackdown on indigenous and rural Hondurans. It said more than 120 people have been killed since 2010. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barté in Washington. Today is Wednesday, the first day of February, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's Charles Taylor said he forgives President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
I really want to say to Ellen, well, if I did anything to you today on my process number, I forgive you, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, for all you have done to me. And I ask all those that love me.
That's former Liberian President Charles Taylor speaking from prison last Saturday to supporters on his 69th birthday. We'll speak with the chairman emeritus of Taylor's National Patriotic Party. A court orders Kenyan police to investigate the disappearance of two South Sudanese nationals, and Gambians consider justice versus moving on.
There seems to be a very clear case for the perpetrators, who appear to be state-employed actors or persons affiliated to the state, or at least had access to state facilities that carried out these actions. So there is a case, a criminal case to answer.
That's Gambian lawyer Aziz Bensouda. UNICEF says millions of children caught in conflicts risk death from malnutrition. And an experimental drug boosts HIV therapy's effectiveness. Those stories, plus our Black History Month facts, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Liberian President Charles Taylor, who is serving a 50-year sentence in Britain for war crimes, says he has forgiven Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf for turning him into the international justice system. Mr. Taylor made the comment last Saturday during a call to supporters of his National Patriotic Party and former combatants who had gathered at a program to honor his 69th birthday. Taylor said he was made a sacrificial lamb after he was turned into the international justice system through a letter from President Sirleaf.
I want to thank everybody for coming to celebrate my birthday. But before I leave, there's one last thing I want to congratulate everybody for coming. I was incarcerated on a letter by Ellen. That letter really is not a material for me, simply because I think Ellen came on the own because of pressure. I would have done it a different way, but she did it her way, and I have become the sacrificial lamb for the Republic, and I hope our people have benefited in whatever way they have. But this, on my 69th birthday, I really want to say to Ellen, what if I did anything to you today on my 69th birthday, I forgave you, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, for all you have done to me. The pages of Liberia are now sorry because of the action, but I forgave you. And I ask all those that love me to forgive her too. And I say to Ellen, she has sufficient time to straighten up all of the wrongful acts that she has perpetrated against me and maybe still doing. I forgave her today, and I hope she will hear this and understand that Liberia is bigger than all of us combined.
Mr. Taylor told the story of the scorpion and a frog to illustrate how he said he had been betrayed, and he told his supporters to beware of the scorpion.
I am reminded of the story of the frog and the scorpion. The frog and the scorpion went to the river. The scorpion came after an equitable cross. So the scorpion said to the frog, you can swim. Don't leave me here. Take me across the river. Frog said, this is very dangerous. You scorpion, you have a tail, you can kill me. Scorpion said, no, trust me, I'm your friend, take me across. Well, frog should have done better. Frog put scorpion on his back. And frog swam across the river. When they got to the other side, scorpion just defended frog and killed frog. So I'm reminded of me being that frog, and I took those scorpions across the river with me. And what they are doing now, a few of them, they have now stung me with their tails. So I really want to say to all of you that have been discouraged, do not be the scorpion. That will let frog push me across and after you have benefited, try to kill me, frog. And I want to remind you to be mindful, very, very mindful of me. I'll tell you these stories for you to know the difficulties that affect me. Do not be persuaded by the scorpion. That is telling the frog, take me across and I'll be okay. It would not be okay. So I want you to be on this birthday as my present for all of our people to return to their base, the base, the NPP. The NPP grew out of the NPSL. Return to your base. And
Mr. Taylor said he left Liberia with no property or money of his own and has nothing outside of Liberia. The chairman emeritus of former President Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Party says Mr. Taylor has no influence over decisions made by the party. The NPP has entered into a coalition with George Weah's Congress for Democratic Change Party. Chief Cyril Allen is the chairman emeritus of the NPP.
I was very emotional about it too, because I did not expect that, but that's what happened. And that's, on the other hand, he wanted people to know that the political party is an independent institution and they have competent human resources, competent manpower in the party that will make decisions on the future of the party. And that, I mean, he was not in any framework of mind or any position to be able to dictate what the party does. But he commended the partisans and the leadership of the party for keeping the institution together and hope that they would continue to do that, basically.
As you know, your party, Mr. Taylor's former party, has aligned with the party of George Weah in some kind of coalition. Did he come out to clearly support any candidate or his former wife and or George Weah, who are now running mates?
No, I've been regularly on telephone with former President Taylor in the last few months. And believe me or not, Jimmy, at no time does he think that he can direct or give any instructions with regard to the party leadership. We are independent people. We are making decisions while Taylor was here. He objected to some of the major decisions that he tried to make within the party. And so there's no way now that you would see our party leadership would be one that would be spearheaded or controlled or directed by Mr. Taylor. Especially, we are not of the opinion that he made some of the best political decisions when he was here. Otherwise, he would not be incarcerated and maybe he would not have had to leave office. So politically, I think the leadership of the party now, including myself, who's chairman emeritus and member of the advisory board, I would direct the party and give suggestions on how to move and try to maintain stability, harmony, and peace in the country as an opposition party. Yes, you say we have entered into some kind of coalition. I detest that reference. It is a coalition of political parties that the party has entered into with an understanding from the convention of the party on how to move about that. And we have been working along with the Coalition for Democratic Change, along with the LPEP and the CDC. So we have an effective organization. We have just presented our platform. And I read the platform at the convention. And so basically, decisions were taken by the executive committee of the three political parties to enter into a collaboration of this nature.
Chief Cyril Allen is the chairman emeritus of former President Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Party. He was speaking with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Debate continues in Gambia over how to address alleged abuses under former President Yahya Jammeh's regime. Katarina Hoye has the story from Banjul.
Chidambaro is back at work at his printing shop. His left eye is still swollen and he has a slight limp. 2 weeks ago, soldiers burst in and beat him with the guns before throwing him in a cell at the National Intelligence Agency. They said his crime was that he had been printing T-shirts for opposition.
It was very terrible on that day because I was not thinking that I'll be back in home safe. Yeah. I thought they're going to kill me because they said it before. They said they're going to kill me.
Barrow says he will not pursue any legal action related to his illegal detention. He says Gambia needs to move on now that ex-president Yahya Jammeh is gone. One of President Adama Barrow's first acts after being sworn in early this month was to order the release of all people detained without a charge or conviction. Hundreds of people have flooded out of the state prison and intelligence agency headquarters. Rights group accused Jammeh of presiding over ruthless oppression during his 22 years in power, including torture, forced disappearances and other abuses. The question now is how to best heal the nation. Opposition leader Usain Darbo, who was arrested last year and released last week, says justice can be cathartic.
Those suspicious of each other, you clear the suspicions, and then, you know, we move forward as Gambians for the development of our country.
Gambian lawyer Assis Bensouda is also considering the question.
So there seems to be a very clear case for the perpetrators who appear to be state-employed actors or persons affiliated to the state, or at least had access to state facilities that carried out these actions. So there is a case, a criminal case to answer.
But he says building cases could be difficult.
Wounds heal, people run away, witnesses run away. 22 years is a long time, and there has been very, comparatively little recorded data on these things.
There has been some high-level arrests. Last week, Swiss authorities detained Gambia's former interior minister, Usman Sonko, as he sought asylum. Sonko is accused of torture-related crimes in Gambia as head of police and one of the longest-serving members of Jammeh's regime. Senegal also arrested Gambia's former prison boss, General Borakoli, as he tried to escape to Guinea-Bissau. It is not clear what will happen to the two men, whether they will be sent back to Gambia. President Barrow has pledged to reform the security services and organize a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, modeled on the one in South Africa post-apartheid. But he has declined to say whether the state will pursue any prosecutions. Presidential spokesman Khalifa Sala says for now the government is on a fact-finding mission, urging Gambians to report missing and detained people.
In a situation where people are also asking for development to take place, resources to be put to address concerns, would it be much better to use those resources to compensate the victim rather than just proceed, you know, in another process? I think these are the issues that he has looked at as a head of state.
VOA spoke to many Gambians who share that pragmatic approach. They want compensation, and they want their old jobs back and their property that they say was taken under Jammeh. And most importantly, they want their relatives freed and the truth about those who will never come home. Meanwhile, ex-president Yahya Jammeh is beginning his life as an exile in Equatorial Guinea. The country is not a signatory to the Rome Statute. Legal experts says Jammeh may well be beyond the reach of Gambian or international justice. Catherine Haye for VOA News in Banjul.
Today's Wednesday, the first day of February, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout-outs to listeners on our affiliate stations, Radio Banga FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, and Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. A Kenyan court has ordered the police to investigate a South Sudanese security officer implicated in the disappearance of two South Sudanese nationals in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. South Sudanese activist Samion Dong and an opposition official, Agrey Adri, were reported missing since last week. The Kenyan government said it has no knowledge of their whereabouts. The two South Sudanese have been critics of the government of President Salva Kiir. Elizabeth Deng is a South Sudanese researcher with Amnesty International. She says there is little progress on the case of the two South Sudanese who went missing a week ago.
The main purpose of the hearing was to hear the government's report into its investigation into the disappearance of Dong Samuel and Agrey Idri. Unfortunately, the government really had very little information to present, actually nothing at all. And I think generally there was disappointment with the government's inability to provide new information. The one new development is that the government announced they would be pursuing an individual by the name of John Top Lam, who's believed to be a South Sudanese intelligence officer stationed in Nairobi as a main suspect. On the side of the applicants, their lawyers shared that they had reason to believe that this intelligence officer had information that would implicate the Kenyan intelligence services as well in the disappearance of Dong and Agrey. Now, after the discussions, the judge ordered the applicants' lawyers to share any information they had that could assist the government in its investigation, and the judge ordered for another hearing to take place on Thursday.
Is there any hope for justice?
Certainly, it puts, you know, this would, if, you know, if true, would put the Kenyan government in a difficult situation, and, you know, the Kenyan police who are charged with the investigation in a bit of a difficult situation. But certainly we hope that they will be able to, you know, independently discharge their mandate. And if that leads to indicating that members of the Kenyan government were themselves involved in the disappearance of Dong and Agre, that they would, you know, present that information and allow the facts to be seen, and that justice be done, regardless of who it leads to.
What are some of the other actors, human rights groups, saying regarding this matter?
Well, there are certainly a lot of Kenyan organizations and, you know, around the world, particularly, you know, international human rights and legal organizations. And, of course, you know, South Sudanese as well. There were many in the audience. I think there's generally a real concern. Now it's been 1 week, and there is still no information, no clear information about their exact whereabouts, and no one has had any contact or seen them since their disappearance. So I think, you know, this is an ongoing cause for really deep concern and anxiety among people who just hope to see them found safe and return to their families.
The family members of Dong and Agri Idri, were they visible at the courts, and how was their mood?
I think it's not hard to imagine that they are obviously anxious. They're obviously disappointed by the lack of answers that, you know, have been produced. And, of course, they're very sad. And, yes, they have been, numerous family members from both Dong and Agre have been present during the court hearings today and on Friday. And, of course, you know, have great interest in ensuring that their loved ones are found.
If there is one message you would like to give to the Kenyan government, what would that message be?
Our message to the Kenyan government would be that they should diligently and thoroughly investigate this disappearance and ensure that even if it implicates the Kenyan intelligence service or other Kenyan authorities, or if it implicates South Sudanese intelligence service and therefore has diplomatic political implications, we're calling on the Kenyan courts and the police to really allow the investigation to take its place and to ensure that those who are, in fact, responsible are brought to justice and held accountable, regardless of who they are.
That's Elizabeth Deng, Amnesty International researcher for South Sudan. She was speaking with VOA's John Tanza from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The UN Children's Fund says millions of children caught in conflict and other crises are at risk of dying from severe acute malnutrition if they do not receive life-saving therapeutic treatment. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where UNICEF has just launched a $3.3 billion appeal on behalf of 81 million people, more than half of them children, in need of emergency assistance.
The largest amount of money, or $1.4 billion, will go toward helping 17 million children and families caught up in war inside Syria and living as refugees in five neighboring countries. Half of the beneficiaries are children. Syria will enter its seventh year of war in March. UN Children's Fund Emergency Programs Director Manuel Fontaine says Syria is the largest humanitarian crisis the agency is facing.
Particular concern is the situation of the about 400,000 children who are actually in besieged areas as we speak right now, as you can imagine the conditions in which they are at the moment and the whole difficulty of access. And as, of course, generous as the host countries have been so far, there's still a lot of concern over the education of those refugee children, over the fact that in many cases they are forced to work and are at risk of many protection threats in general.
UNICEF estimates 7.5 million children will face severe acute malnutrition in most of the 48 countries in crisis, with the largest number and most serious cases in northeast Nigeria, Yemen, South Sudan, and Somalia. UNICEF Yemen representative Marixel Grelano says the situation for children in Yemen is catastrophic.
Definitely children are dying of malnutrition, that is for sure. The children that are not being reached by us or by the programs that are treating severe acute malnutrition are dying. And the under 5 mortality rate has increased to the point that we estimate that at least in 2016, 10,000 more children died of preventable diseases.
The agency says its appeal will provide a lifeline for tens of millions of children over the coming year by providing food, access to clean water and sanitation, health services, and education. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
February is Black or African American History Month here in the United States. And each morning during the month of February, Daybreak Africa will profile historical African Americans and African individuals and events. You may also send us any historical event of your country in the month of February. Now, here are our African American and African history facts for today, February 1st. On this day in 1926, historian Carter G. Woodson started Negro History Week to focus attention on the contribution that African Americans and black people everywhere have made to the development of the United States and the world. Later in 1976, Negro History Week was expanded to cover the entire month of February to give more time in celebration of black history. Also on this day in 1960, four black college students started the sit-in movement at a segregated five and dime store in Greensboro, North Carolina, to protest the denial of service. The action is viewed by many historians as one of the biggest events of the early civil rights movement. On this day in 1906, African-American poet, novelist, and playwright Langston Hughes was born in Joplin, Missouri. In his many writings, Hughes documented some of the excitement and disappointment of black people during the Harlem Renaissance movement. And on this day in 1978, the first stamp in U.S. Black Heritage Series was issued in honor of Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman was a runaway slave who became a legend because of a role in the Underground Railroad movement, the system by which slaves in the southern part of the United States were led to freedom in the north. And on this day in African history in 1963, the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland was broken up. Nyasaland, now Malawi, moved towards independence under the leadership of Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda and the Nyasaland African National Congress. Those are your Black History Month facts for today, February 1st. We will begin our contest tomorrow, February 2nd. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Vandy, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day. You want to listen to the latest African music? Dance to the best African beat from across the African continent? Then you don't have a problem. Just tune in to the African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time. African beat, the show that brings happiness into your homes, smiles on your faces. So join me, your host, David Vandy, Monday through Friday, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time on The Voice of America.
African beats is the best. It's number one. We love it.